Thanks very much, Amy. As she mentioned, I work in the general medical epidemiology section of our state health department, but work very closely with the Maine Immunization Program and have shared this adventure in particular with Alexander Dragazzi, who is our immunization program epidemiologist, who is also here in the room today. What I'd like to do is to talk about, basically to review the epidemiological features of the ongoing incidence of mumps cases in Maine over the past 6 months, to talk about some challenges in clinical and laboratory diagnosis and in case classification, and then also about challenges that we see with disease control and communication, and there are plenty of those. Sort of an overview, we've seen more than 100 laboratory confirmed and suspect cases. It's a mix of laboratory confirmed and suspect cases without any direct evidence of virus, no PCR or culture positives during this time, and all of our confirmed cases have been confirmed by IgM testing. We have seen little evidence of direct person-to-person or sustained mumps transmission in these cases, and we have a significantly older age distribution than has been seen in other recent mumps outbreaks, as Al was describing. This has also been a pretty resource-intensive process for both public health and for the affected persons and institutions in Maine. You'll be hearing a little bit about Canada shortly, and I just wanted to note that we are obviously quite close to Canada. We have a long border with New Brunswick, and which is one of the affected provinces, a fair amount of traffic back and forth, and we're fairly close to the to Halifax, which was the epicenter of the outbreak that began in 2007. But despite this, we have no direct evidence that we're linked to the Canadian outbreak. I want to start this back in September by describing our first case, who was a 42-year-old man who vaguely remembered being immunized, but not much more in terms of his history, who had no travel, who had no other definite mumps exposures when he was interviewed, and at the time he was reported on September 28th had been symptomatic for 11 days and had had two hospitalizations in the same institution for peritonitis and orchitis. And he was reported when his IgM test at a commercial laboratory came back. As noted, we didn't identify any epidemiologic links to Canada or to any other cases, no other travel. But on about the 8th of October, several weeks later, we received a report from another clinician in a different area of the state of a 34-year-old woman with peritonitis who also tested IgM positive. Again, there were no epidemiologic links between the two. However, on interview of patient number two, we learned that her husband had had an onset of peritonitis in a fairly classic clinical story for mumps, was subsequently IgM positive, and his onset had been on about the same day as patient one. And when Alex Dragazzi interviewed them, he discovered that they had a common contact, which was attending a rock concert in a small nightclub venue in Portland about 3 weeks earlier. It was kind of a heavy metal thrash mosh pit type of a concert with somebody reporting about 600 people in a relatively small room. So we assumed that it was plausible that these two had had an exposure, common exposure at that time. And we've had no other cases linked nor heard anything else from other states about cases linked to this particular venue. Well, that was the first series of close epidemiologic links between cases in our more than 140 subsequent reports, and it was also our last evidence of close epidemiologic contact between cases. And our story now continues on through the rest of the fall and into this spring. And we've had a total of 26 cases which have been confirmed through IgM testing per the new case definition. 74 cases who have a clinically compatible illness, but either were not tested or have negative testing for IgM and PCR, and who are considered suspect cases, no cases who meet the probable case definition. 40 of the cases that we investigated are considered to be non-cases after investigations were complete. This should say 2007 case definition that Al referred to earlier, And again, a confirmed case is a clinically compatible case with either a positive IgM, PCR or culture, or rise in titers. And again, in our case, all of our confirmed cases were made using IgM. And the suspect case is a clinically compatible case without any laboratory evidence of infection. This is the EPI curve for our suspected and confirmed cases during this six-month period beginning in September. And as you can see, in week 42, we issued a health advisory after we had a small number of cases, basically just updating. This is focused to clinicians and to other health institutions, letting them know that we had mumps cases here and giving them some basic diagnostic and reporting information. We saw a brief upsurge the following week and then began to see in November increasing incidence of cases, which rose sharply right around the time the week before Thanksgiving. And it was also at that time that we had issued our second health advisory, which had much more detail and more direction on laboratory diagnostics and clinical evaluation of patients. And during the next month, basically between Thanksgiving and New Year's, saw our cases, most of which, as you can see, were suspect cases, with a relatively small proportion of cases confirmed. And then after the end of the Christmas holiday, we've leveled off and have continued to see 1 to 3 cases on average reported per week, most of those suspect cases without confirmation. You don't really need to look at this, but this was the kind of complicated diagram that we put out for clinicians with suggestions on which tests to get and when, including the use of a buccal swab earlier in illness and urine for PCR and culture later in illness, as well as the IgM. I'm not sure in retrospect that this helped with any clear up any confusion, but it was specific. Something that's been very different about our cases than the ones that Al was describing in the Midwest, and different, I think, also from the Canadian cases, is the age distribution. Here you see confirmed cases in light blue and suspect cases in purple by age and decade. And our median age and mean age of cases were actually in their mid-30s. We had relatively small proportion of both suspect and confirmed cases in the college age group. And a fairly significant proportion of our cases, as you can see, were over 35. And if you look here on about the third line for 18 to 24-year-olds, you'll see that only about 20% of our suspect cases and about 15% of our confirmed cases were in that college age group of 18 to 24 years old. So very different than what had been seen in the Midwest. Of course, peritonitis defines our suspect cases in most reports. 97% of our confirmed and suspect mumps cases had peritonitis. 2% were reported as also or only having orchitis. That was two cases. Two cases had pancreatitis. One had aseptic meningitis. And 6 of these 100 cases were hospitalized at some point during their illness. There were no deaths. The gender breakdown for our confirmed cases was 50-50, and for our suspect cases was about 60-40 female versus male cases. Cases were distributed across Maine without any particular concentration beyond beyond the areas of higher population, with rates during that six-month period that went up to about 13 per 100,000 in the counties. And again, this was essentially a statewide event, and without any particular predilection for the areas close to the New Brunswick border, which is what we thought that we might see. As Al also mentioned, we had difficulty getting great vaccine dose histories. For our 26 confirmed cases of mumps, about a third of them reported 2 doses of MMR. About a quarter had 1 dose. 2 of them were pretty sure that they had not been vaccinated. That's 8%. And data, while most of our cases younger than 50 remembered vaguely having vaccine, we had no good information on the number of doses. Similarly, for our suspect cases, about 20% had 2 doses. about 15% one dose. Only 5% were reported to have had no vaccine, and others under 50 reported vaccination, they think, but nothing very specific. So for diagnostic testing, our laboratory utilizes a PCR test. It was one developed by the Iowa State Lab and CDC. We've had extensive discussions with the folks at the CDC laboratories, and actually we're having conference calls weekly or every other week for much of the fall and winter. And this testing was validated using CDC panels and some of our previous clinical specimens, and we were doing PCR and culture on both buccal swab and urine specimens, mostly buccal swab. Serum IgM testing was done at the CDC lab until December, where they used their IgM capture ELISA test. And then for the last 2 months to increase our, or to decrease our turnaround time, we have used a commercial kit at our lab from Microimmune, which is a British company, using an IgM capture ELISA, again validated with CDC panels. 113 of our 140 reported possible cases were tested using mumps IgM. Some of these were from commercial laboratories. 26 of those were positive. That defines our population of confirmed cases. We had a fair number of indeterminates. Most of them were negative, and some of that data is missing. For buccal swab specimens tested by PCR and by viral culture, there were 91 tests done, and they were all negative, including 17 done on our 26 IgM-positive patients. Two-thirds of our suspect cases were tested and were negative, and about more than half of our non-cases also tested negative. Because, as Al mentioned, there are a number of infectious agents that can cause peritonitis, we were particularly interested in looking at some data from our influenza surveillance system, just looking at three laboratories, our state lab and two large reference laboratories that work in state, just looking to see what they were seeing in terms of other circulating viruses. And of course, this is biased by the fact that they are primarily testing young children for RSV and in more recently patients with influenza-like illnesses rather than mumps-like illnesses. But as you can see here, the biggest bulk of cases, positives, were among, were for RSV and influenza. We did have 11 to 13 cases of paraflu 1 and paraflu 2, respectively. We had a few paraflu 3s and, of course, a scattering also of adeno and enterovirus, so this didn't help us much. And we do encourage, any time that we get tests, do encourage the clinicians to obtain NP swabs for open-ended viral cultures on all of our suspect mumps patients, but relatively few of those end up making it in for reasons that you can guess at along with me. Institutional exposures and outbreaks. We had one college outbreak with two confirmed and seven suspect cases that I'll describe in a minute. We had three other colleges that had sporadic suspect cases in students, a college that had a confirmed case in an employee, and at least five secondary schools with sporadic student or staff suspect cases. None of these involved recognized secondary cases. And we also had three hospitals in which there were exposures to of healthcare workers to confirmed or suspect mumps cases and folks who had to follow the CDC recommendations to bring their staff into compliance. The campus mumps outbreak that I've described occurred at the University of Southern Maine. It's a school with about 6,000 students, many of them commuter students. First case we recognized right before Thanksgiving break on the 17th of November, and our last case had his onset on the 10th of December. As you can imagine, we had very intensive surveillance at the college infirmaries going on after the first cases were recognized. And after the first case was IgM confirmed at about Thanksgiving week, all resident and full-time students then were directed by the university per health department's recommendation slash mandate to the school to come into the full two-dose MMR compliance by December 5th or to be excluded, and the specifics and the date and the mechanisms of exclusion were decided by the college. Over the next few months, more than 900 doses of vaccine were reported to have been given. There was no coverage for the cost of the vaccine, which was $50 a dose, and most of these were given in special clinics at the school. And the school reported that more than 300 students were excluded for at least one day after the deadline on the 5th of December. So here are our concerns and challenges. Our epidemiological concerns are fairly obvious. One is the absence of PCR or culture positive cases, which gives pause to anybody looking at any kind of outbreak. The paucity of epidemiologically linked cases, the unusual age distribution of cases, the fact that we have not seen corollary increases in incidence in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, or other regional states, despite the cases in Canada. And then there is the issue of the relatively low burden of disease versus the relatively high level of resources required for investigation. There are significant questions concerning the validity of peritonitis diagnosis. When we have clinically experienced epidemiologists talking to physicians, it's clear on occasion, as it would be, I think, anywhere, that there are sometimes problems with a differential diagnosis of peritonitis versus cervical adenitis, particularly when you have a clinician reporting that he has a patient with peritonitis who also has anterior and posterior cervical nodes. We have problems with patients or with clinicians distinguishing palpable parotid versus pain at the angle of the jaw. And then the bane of our existence, which is the report of vague fullness in the parotid area, which is a very frequent report, and it's not, you can't really pin people down sometimes in terms of trying to get a good enough description of this kind of vague or marginal exam finding as to whether peritonitis is really present. There's issues always exist, but perhaps nothing quite like peritonitis in my experience. And there's also the role of surveillance bias. Obviously, the health advisories and news reports got people to the doctor, got doctors looking a little bit more carefully, and made us wonder about what the real background rate of low-level peritonitis is. Diagnostic challenges include sensitivity of PCR and viral culture. How sensitive are they? How specific are our IgM serological tests? How can we do a better job to get nasopharyngeal swabs to rule out other etiologies like parainfluenza? And we have ongoing problems getting specimens to our state lab, as we do for many other disease entities. And this involves a great deal of shepherding and making sure that they don't go into nowhere or end up going to a commercial laboratory where they will take several weeks for results to be done and where we won't get our buccal swabs tested. Disease control challenges, I think we can talk about this a little bit later, but we have not, I think, answered the question yet as to whether partially vaccinated individuals need to be excluded for 5 days versus 9 days after the onset of illness. And again, I think that's a good discussion. Another question for us is whether we should consider all peritonitis cases mumps until proven otherwise. This is, with numbers of cases, can be somewhat disruptive. Do we keep people out of school and work until all our laboratory results are back? Do we let people go back to work if their PCR and IgM are negative when they have clinically compatible cases and we know false negative tests are a significant issue with mumps? And finally, how aggressively do we investigate and impose disease control measures when the disease burden at this point is recognized as appears to be fairly low, when transmission, at least direct transmission, seems limited, and when diagnosis is very difficult to rule in or rule out. Communication issues in explaining some of these issues, for example, the urgency of vaccination, when most cases occur in vaccinated persons, it's a hard public health message to make. And with clinicians working with our field epidemiologists to get a better level of communication so that they can be more effective in eliciting good information about the parotid exams, as we talked about a little bit earlier. So this is a perplexing outbreak. There are no easy answers to this, I'm afraid. The outbreak has tested the patience of public health professionals, clinicians, and obviously the people who are affected and the institutions that are affected, particularly the college. Investigations are highly resource intensive. The silver lining is that we are improving second dose MMR in people who should be vaccinated. And I particularly want to thank Alex Dragazzi in this and our other collaborators at the Maine Health Department. Thanks very much.